Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers number 42, Entropic Gravity. Show notes for this episode can be found at www.physicsfm.com/42. Show notes include related episodes, books mentioned in this program, and links to the papers that we're about to discuss, if you want to follow along. Hey, Randy, how's it going?
It's good to hear from you, Jim. It's been too long.
Yeah, it's been a very long time. We've only had one episode come out this year so far.
Holy.
Well, I mean, what can you do? So, other than, you know, get on your phone and talk to people.
Well, that's work.
Yeah, we'll try that one this time. Let's see. So, what did you want to talk about today, Randy?
Well, you took a shine to the concept of entropic gravity when we were talking about ideas for shows. So we jumped into that and you found a couple of good papers and I get the impression that you rather like this. And I have to say, I'm thrilled with it also.
You know, I took this from your email to me and you'd had two papers on it, I think, The Origin of Gravity and the Laws of Newton, which we are going to talk about, by Eric Berlinde. And another one that mixed up a whole bunch of cool stuff, Entropic Force, Non-Commutative Gravity, and Ungravity by Nicolini, I believe. And I read that had too much stuff. So, I mean, I did find a couple of other papers that were pretty good, but, you know, these are kind of long. So looks like we've got one on testing Berlinde's emergent gravity in early type galaxies by Tortora, Koopmans, Napolitano, and Valentin, I think. Did you read that other one that I mentioned? Because you sounded like you were kind of interested in that one by Carroll.
I didn't have time to go over that one, but I am interested in it.
So that was also an interesting one. What is the Entropy in Entropic Gravity by Sean Carroll and Grant Remen? So maybe we can talk a little bit about that and what's in that at some point.
I'd like to hear that.
Okay, so what did you understand about entropic gravity? What did it actually mean?
We've got a whole new approach here. Verlinde, he's from Amsterdam, I guess, the university there, and he's taking an entirely new look at not just gravity, but he's also modeling space-time as an emergent phenomenon by looking at closed surfaces around a volume where mass and energy and entropy determine all of the gradients and where space and gravity emerge out of that. So temperature and entropy and mass all play into like an underlying architecture to everything that we thought was classically irreducible, like space, time, and gravity.
Did you understand the idea about the rubber band?
Well, yeah, he had sort of like some kind of polymer analogy where at a certain temperature, a polymer that has like unlimited or virtually unlimited degrees of freedom will kind of wrap itself up into a randomized kind of knot. And he's talked about how it takes energy to straighten it out because then you're reducing its entropy. And then there's a direct relationship between the amount of force that it takes to straighten it out and the amount of entropy that you're pulling out of the system, basically. And so this is the example that he uses as a force, as an entropic force, which isn't a microscopic fundamental force, but rather an emergent force. And then he extrapolates that concept to gravity and space-time.
I'm not sure exactly how good that analogy is. It's a really fundamental thing. It's how a rubber band actually works, right? You know, you have basically this random walk for the polymer. And how should I say this? The most probable state for that is basically both ends being at the same distance. It's just a big clump, a big ball. When you pull it apart, you do work, right? Which is sort of force times distance. And that's thermodynamic work, so that's equal to temperature times the entropy. And so, you know, you can relate the entropy to the work that you're doing that way and end up with a force based on, as you pull it apart, the number of different ways you can have the two ends of the polymer be this farther and farther distance out becomes fewer and fewer and fairly quickly. But that force gives you the energy to pull it out. And that's sort of the analogy that he used. There's some other things like osmosis that work in a similar way with the entropy gradients. And I think probably those make a little more sense as something that has to do with gravity than the rubber bands, because I'm not sure how you can think of those rubber bands at a microscopic level, right?
Right.
Whereas something like osmosis, it makes a little more sense. All of this had something to do with these holographic spheres, the information in these spheres radiating out from, you know, some point mass or something like that. I guess it doesn't have to be a point mass. And that's the entropy that was associated with that, is as you look at a sphere, the amount of information you're getting from the inside, from that mass inside, is the same, you know, whether or not you have a sphere that's, let's say, one astronomical unit in diameter or two astronomical units in diameter. So you have the same information in a smaller space, and that means that as you increase that sphere, you have a difference in that entropy. As you increase that sphere, you have less information density.
We're looking at an envelope, like a spherical envelope that surrounds that body of matter or that collection of gas or whatever. And if you double the diameter of that sphere, then you've got like four times the surface area. So if you're mapping the information onto that surface, then you've got a lower force, right? Because there's a lower information density on that surface. It's really kind of, it's a very bizarre and absolutely fascinating way to look at the problem.
And it reminds you of Gauss's law. I mean, if you look at what he's doing, it reminds you very much of Gauss's law. So Gauss's law for gravity would be basically, if you take the outgoing gravitational field along a fake sphere in space-time, mm-hmm. So you just take the outgoing component of that gravitational field, integrate it over that entire region. If it's uniform, that would be the field times the area of that sphere, the 4 pi r squared. Mm-hmm. That's going to be equal to the total mass that's inside of that sphere. Basically, that would be a triple integral over the density inside of that sphere. Integrate over that entire volume, find the total mass inside, and that sort of relates your gravitational field to your density. And there's a constant in there. There's a constant that has to do with the gravitational constant G. That looks very, very much like what he's talking about, right? Because he comes in here and he basically says what's happening here is the total energy is equal to the total energy in the matter sense, the rest mass energy, is equal to the total energy in the thermodynamic sense, which is basically more or less the number of particles times the temperature with constants. And so you end up with that interesting sort of result there. So basically you have an integral over what ends up being this temperature times the entropy gradient. So the temperature times this entropy gradient, whatever that actually means, is equal to the total energy inside of that sphere. And he's just using this rest mass energy, but I wonder if all the energy inside of that sphere in the real world, right? So he's got this little toy model that he's building up right now, but I think that would have to be everything from vacuum energy to electromagnetic energy, any kind of energy that's in there, that probably has to be accounted for.
Yeah, it sounds like he developed that modeling further in his subsequent paper, which they tested. In testing Verlinde's emergent gravity in early type galaxies paper that you found, because I remember reading in that paper that they talked about how his predictions would diverge more from the Mond models, for example, and when they include the hot gases that surround the core of those spherical galaxies, because a hot gas like that contributes a lot more entropy, and so the predictions are going to be a lot different, you know.
Yeah, I mean, something like that would have to happen. Now, MOND is what? The modified Newtonian dynamics, right?
Yeah.
Which is trying to account for this missing mass for that low acceleration regime at the ends of the spiral arms of galaxies.
Yeah, but the problem with MOND that I see is it doesn't seem to have much of a theoretical basis. You know, there's an underlying logic to why it should do that. It seems like it's kind of a hand-fit idea. And the nice thing about this is it's like built from first principles.
Yeah, so when he was talking about it, at least, he was talking about like this interpolating function, and it seems like that interpolating function has at least three different formulations that Tortora thinks are good. One from Milgram in 1983, the original one. And since I can't read what I wrote in my notes, I'll just say one from 2005 and one from 2016, which is very interesting. It's also interesting that at least this Tortora guy, when he did his data fitting, got a really good number for the Hubble constant. It was like 76 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is within 1 kilometer per second per megaparsec of the accepted value.
Right. And even the error bar has been, I think, larger than that deviation with different analyses. I think I've seen it at 73, you know, so definitely right in the sweet spot.
Yeah, that makes a really nice argument right there. I did not finish The Emergent Gravity and the Dark Universe, which is Relindy's paper that I think he was using. May not have been, because that came out at about the same time.
I think he must have been referencing that, maybe a preprint of it, though, because he talks a lot about how he added like a volume function in the subsequent work from 2017 or 16. That was a big part of their modeling. And none of that came up in the first paper, so he must have been working with him on the second one.
It seems about right, but it's one of these things. I only have the archive version, so I can't tell from his references whether or not that's the same paper I was reading this morning. Okay, so what interesting things did we find out? Did you think anything was particularly interesting or troublesome?
I really loved it when he modeled the equipotential surface around a collection of masses on their constant redshift, because that seems like a really intuitive way to define the energy within that volume and the entropy within that volume. And he even starts talking in this paper about how there are great cosmological opportunities to look at this model. So it was nice to see the follow-up that you found in that paper by, let's see, Tortora and Koopmans and Napolitano, etc. So the other thing that kind of stumped me is that he made it through this whole paper without really talking about any potential technological implications. It seems to me that if this really is like a more fundamental way to model gravity than Einstein's model, and even space-time, for that matter. I mean, space-time emerges from this. I haven't quite gotten my head around how that works, other than I think it has something to do with the entropy and energy distribution. But why didn't it occur to him to talk about the possible technological ramifications for this? I mean, if gravity and the curvature of space-time, if this is an emergent property of these factors like entropy and temperature, then there must be technological ways to exploit this and test this, right?
Well, there might be. It depends on how big the effect actually is inside of the gravity well, right? You would need to get some sort of entropy gradient that's large enough. I'm not sure how you do that. So I don't know how to make entropy gradients, so.
Yeah, me either, but there's got to be quantum physicists who'd probably know how to do that. Maybe you could create some kind of material and saturate its entropy somehow. Yeah, I'm not even sure what kind of modalities this would be restricted to. Like, maybe you could engineer a material with multiple degrees of freedom to create like a really high entropy like sponge, basically, and test if you could actually synthetically generate a gravitational field that way.
That would be ideal, is that you'd be able to somehow produce a force with that entropy gradient that would be gravity-like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would be pretty awesome. But again, I don't have a really good idea about what the size of that you could expect is, right? With sort of the temperatures that we have on Earth and the various constants here, what exactly would you need? Mm. I mean, especially if it's only really giving you these variations at really large scales, right? So if you're seeing with these other guys these variations at large scales, it might be just too small to see at any small scale.
Say you had two different materials and you could engineer the situation so that you had one that was extremely low entropy and the other one that was extremely high entropy on the other side, then you should be able to exploit that gradient that he was talking about so that you'd be able to generate a gravitational acceleration in there.
Yeah, well, I guess we'd have to look at what they do in refrigeration, because that's how they do a lot of things like magnetic refrigeration and stuff like that. I mean, there might be some tell with something like a ferroelectric refrigerator or something like that. You might be able to take some of those devices and do something with them.
The refrigerators don't have any like moving parts. They just basically pull entropy out of the system.
It's awesome. It's awesome the way they work.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen one of those things?
I've only read about them online.
If you ever try to pick one up, it's just so weird because, you know, a normal refrigerator, I mean, even a little like dorm refrigerator or something like that, those things are heavy. Well, these things are just like a box, right? You pick it up and it's like picking up a plastic box of the same size.
Like a styrofoam cooler. That's awesome.
It is great the way they work.
And their efficiency is totally limited just by materials engineering, right?
I think materials engineering is probably most things, but there's going to be other things like temperature gradients, the size of the heat baths and stuff like that. So there'll be some other things that'll be important somewhere in there. But as far as I understand these things, and I could be completely wrong, if you have a larger temperature gradient, then you have a higher efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Really matter, because even though you have a higher efficiency, then you have to do more work anyway. So that might be another thing, is some place where you have a really large temperature gradient, even something like the sea or something like that can be much cooler. The water can be much cooler than the air or in some places a lot warmer. So you might be able to do something in one of those sorts of areas.
That's interesting. Yeah, this idea of using thermodynamics to produce gravitational effects has really got my mind on fire.
Oh, good, good. That'll give you something to do.
Because I'd like to spend a week or two just going over this and playing with it and seeing what kind of numbers come out. Like, what would it take to try to create a lab experiment to test it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could. So, I mean, you've got the piezoelectric or the ferroelectric cooling elements.
Mm-hmm.
So you could get one of those in a light ball and just see if you turn the cooling elements on and off, if you can get it to start oscillating. You might have to try to, you know, get the time constants aligned with the period of the pendulum, but something like that might be interesting. I don't think it'll work, but I mean, it's something you can try, and for under $100.
Right. Well, you know, nowadays with laser interferometers, you can detect really, really subtle gravitational fields. You know, we could always take one to Livingston, test it out at the LIGO experiment.
Yeah, it's not under $100 anymore. But you can try something like that, see what actually happens. And obviously, if you're at NASA and you need somebody to try that, my summer's free.
Got to volunteer.
for a stipend and some equipment, yeah. Let's see. Now, the thing is that in this emergent gravity and the dark universe, somehow, and I don't really understand this, Berlinde was relating this to the Higgs branch and the Coulomb branch. The Higgs branch is basically dark energy, which has equipartition of all degrees of freedom for this field. And the Coulomb branch is basically the matter branch. And so those are bound states that escape the dark energy branch, the Higgs branch. And he was talking about this as the memory effects of the dark elastic phase of emergent gravity. So this is how he was talking about it. And I thought that was kind of interesting. So that in this, a lot of it seems to be directed at the entropy that's coming from lots and lots of, in this case, strings. You know, these quantum mechanical string things that they play with in string theory. So that was where he was talking about it in that paper. In fact, the way he's talking about it is that this entropy that's creating the space-time, that's creating the gravity, has something to do with entanglement. So quantum entanglement is what's behind all that stuff.
Yeah, that didn't come up in the first paper, did it?
No, it did not come in the first paper. I think that's something that, as this theory has evolved, is becoming important. I first read about it in Sean Carroll's paper, right, where he was talking about two different kinds, the holographic gravity, which is the one with the entanglement, and the thermodynamic gravity, which is more like the original paper. And he was saying that the entropy in that holographic idea with the entanglement, he could make an argument that there was a well-defined entropy there, but for this original paper, he doesn't think that entropy is really well-defined. Yeah, and I'm a little bit concerned about that as well. So I'm not really sure what's happening there. I mean, the idea about the entropy gradient makes it sound to me like there's a good idea that it's because they're not in equilibrium. But then at that point, you're asking yourself, well, how well-defined is that entropy? That's why I was interested in the Carroll paper, and that's something that's actually a little interesting. So the entropy that Berlinde uses is what? The Bekenstein entropy, which is basically something that was derived from black hole physics.
Right, where I guess it is easy to define it in that situation.
I'm not sure if it was easy to define it, but people did define it, right?
Right.
So they have a number for that, and I mean, it's perfectly, or not a number, but they have an expression for that, and it's a perfectly reasonable expression, and people are happy with it. But I'm not sure how that works in general. And how well-defined it really is.
Do you think that's why Verlinde seems to have abandoned the thermodynamic language and gone in more in favor of the holographic entangled language?
No, I think it just sounds a lot cooler. To be honest, personally, I really like that idea about the entanglement, right? I've always had this feeling that entanglement had something to do with the nature of space. So that, you know, the relationships between things are primary, and there aren't just a lot of little points in space-time hanging out. It's the relationships between things give us something that looks like something like space-time. I'm very attracted to that particular interpretation. I'm not sure if it's true, but it's something that I find very attractive. I think it's something that makes the entire theory sound a lot better. And I think it's something that people have been doing a lot with recently. That's probably why, is that a lot of people have been looking at it, and that it seems to put the theory on a more solid foundation.
Did this all start with the black hole information paradox, or did that this go back even further? Like, I wasn't sure how Bekenstein – did that predate the black hole information paradox? Because it seems like this is all tied into that somehow. Because entropy and information and the conservation of information, I remember there being a big controversy. I think Stephen Hawking was involved with it about, you know, does information get lost when it goes inside an event horizon? You know, it seems like this is all tied in with that kind of that modality of thinking.
I think Bekenstein and Unruh are all sort of contemporaneous with Hawking's black hole information stuff.
It's interesting to see something this fundamental, wow, come out of that kind of a debate, you know, about it seemed like a very technical specialty, like, okay, what really does happen when information goes into a black hole? And here it's just kind of awesome to see this entire new formulation of space-time and gravity arise from those considerations. And he's formulated them really nicely here. I mean, first I was just kind of stunned to see him come up with the basic Newtonian equation, but then to see that he could extend that to a relativistic regime and apparently at least provide the base principles to model general relativity was kind of stunning.
When it said the laws of Newton, I was thinking it was going to be a lot less interesting. Well, I shouldn't say a lot less interesting, but, if just because you can model Newton's law of universal gravitation doesn't mean all that. But he also won... sort of found some way to turn this into modeling Newton's second law and went on to do the stuff, Einstein's equations.
Now, remember when we read Clifford Will, his review paper about the status of competing theories, metric theories of gravity and everything? And he felt that everything that was non-metric had been ruled out. But this seems like it's kind of comes in through a back door because it reproduces the physics of a metric gravity theory without being really a metric theory of gravity. It's more fundamental, right? But it comes up with the same predictions in most regimes, right?
I don't know. So I'd have to go back and see if there was a way to formulate this in terms of the way Will defined a metric theory of gravity. Will, I remember, had a definition, and there were previous theories before he made that definition for what a metric theory is that he was able to put into that metric formulation. Basically, I'd have to see if this could be put in that form. I mean, I haven't done any research on this at all, so somebody may have done that already, but I don't know about it.
Okay, yeah. I'd like to dig a little deeper and see if I can find somebody that does a more direct analytical comparison between like metric tensor theories of gravity and this one. But it does make sense that, I mean, with these entropy gradients basically mimicking the curvature of space-time, they would seem to be indistinguishable in most regimes.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd expect that the way that he put this together, this would turn into a metric theory of gravity. But I just don't know. Again, if we looked at this Tortora paper, Tortora says that this has really only been formulated in a specific situation.
Right. It's almost a toy model because it only deals with spherical and uniform density and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. So it doesn't seem like the theory has been formulated in such a way that it would be amenable to that sort of generalization, although it would be useful for somebody to do that. Yeah, if you need something to do.
I'm intrigued by it. I can't help but wonder about what this means for the more exotic concepts that come out of general relativity, like traversable wormholes and warp drives and all that kind of stuff, you know. Does this offer new engineering possibilities or does this rule out any of those? One of the things that I don't see in here is, and it may be in here. I mean, there may be a way to model this. I don't know. But, you know, could you model a negative gravitational field with entropic gravity?
I guess if you could get the entropy to go the wrong way.
Yeah.
So since I don't have a good enough feeling for that, it seems like, based on what he's saying, that you would not model that unless you could model a negative mass.
Well, the thing is that it seems like with the new work, which I only kind of got a hint at through this testing Verlin's emergent gravity in early type galaxies paper, was that it seems like he's modeling the dark energy field as like a baseline state of entropy. So it's got energy, and that seems to create this gravitational acceleration apart. Because it still kind of models the cosmological constant idea where there's energy in every volume of space. And then I guess if you look at it through relativity, it's got these pressure terms which end up giving you a negative value. So if that can be done, can you increase the entropy of the vacuum. He talks about multiple degrees of freedom in the vacuum. But in this paper, they don't really talk about how many different degrees of freedom there are and what they mean physically. Did you see anything like that? Like, how many degrees of freedom are there in the vacuum?
No, I don't see anything where it says you have 6 degrees of freedom and you're stuck with them. The degrees of freedom may be the degrees of freedom for each particle in the universe, in which case it would be something like, you know, 6N or 26N or something like that, depending on, you know, what your favorite theory is.
Did Verlaine, in any of the stuff that you've talked about or read through, have you seen how he models the dark energy field?
I think he models it as that Higgs thing that we were talking about. But beyond that, I haven't really seen that. I may have read over it and just didn't see it. I only got about halfway through that paper, I think. Maybe not even that far. Yeah, I didn't get to the really good thing. So where I didn't get to included things like, oh, the apparent dark matter from emergent gravity, the elastic phase, first law of horizons and the definition of mass, things like that. So I think it could be part of the thing where he was talking about the definition of sort of the horizon. So he was saying something about how there's a difference between a de Sitter space and an anti-de Sitter space and how well defined your horizon can be. And that may be it. But that seems to me to be a little bit circular, because I'd have thought that you wanted to determine whether something was a de Sitter space or an anti-de Sitter space through the theory of gravity, not try to make your theory of gravity based on there already being one of those. I don't think that's the way to look at it, but I'm not sure. That may have been all he was talking about.
In this second paper where he's testing the theory, they talk a lot about the strain caused by the entropy displacement of having baryonic matter in there. Is that strain because the matter has fewer degrees of freedom? Is that the idea? Is that strain like an entropy strain?
I don't remember. So I would guess that that strain has to do with sort of the strain in space-time, right? They go along with the stress. It would be the stretching and compressing of space-time based on the entropy gradient.
Yeah, apparently there's some kind of difference in the entropy between, I guess, free space and matter, and that that their interaction creates this strain. That's really kind of fascinating. It's kind of an informational strain, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think that free space would be that Higgs stuff, and the Coulomb stuff would be the matter. So in the spot where, in places where you have excitations, bound excitations that create matter outside of that Higgs stuff, when you actually have these excitations in the Coulomb branch that are coming out of that Higgs branch, you're reducing the number of possible states, and so you get less entropy, and that would basically be what's causing the strain. So basically, the matter is coming out of the dark matter, or the matter is coming out of the dark energy, which is causing the strain. And the dark energy is everywhere.
But is the dark energy even within, like, nucleons and that kind of stuff? Or is it excluded from those domains, do you think?
I don't see anything here. I would say that it would be running around inside of them at some point.
Well, if he can model gravity using this model, it'd be also be possible to model other fundamental forces and find that maybe they're not so fundamental?
Well, possibly, but I think it sounds like the way he's interpreting it currently, those other fundamental forces are the things that are causing the entropy gradients that are causing the mass. Right? So the things that are coming out of that Higgs branch and becoming matter, then interacting with each other and stuff like that, those things are of a different sort. So they're actual particles interacting with each other. Whereas the idea here is that the fundamental forces, which are particles interacting with each other, are of a different sort than gravity. And gravity has something to do with the likelihood of the states that those other forces are creating with the matter.
I'm just kind of perplexed because we know that electrostatics take the same form, same equation form, as the Newtonian gravity. So it just makes you think, well, I mean, if you can easily derive the Newtonian equation for gravity out of this concept, then why couldn't you also do that for charge interactions?
Well, you might be able to, but you'd have to somehow separate those different things. I think the big thing about it is that really everything has the gravitational interaction.
Right.
But not everything has the Coulomb interaction. So now you're looking at some sort of entropy that if you tried to model that with an entropy, that somehow, like this electrostatic entropy, that didn't interact with anything else. Whereas the nice thing about this is if you take this spot where he's talking about the rest mass energy of this black hole and you turn it into just any old energy, then it affects everything just like gravity does. And then life is good. You know, there's the old hydrostatic analogy, right? And that hydrostatic analogy was very common, especially for electrical conductivity. Well, this is sort of a hydrostatic analogy for gravity. So this is saying that the laws of fluid mechanics are similar to the laws of gravity, are similar to the laws of electricity. And we've been trying to unify forces by saying that the laws of gravity and the laws of electricity are in some way similar, right? So then you have a graviton with spin 2 that does what a photon with spin 1 does. But maybe gravity is more like the fluids, right? And so we're looking at things more in that fluid analogy in this case. But we've kind of gotten away from that fluid idea for electricity.
Yeah, that's when we had the ether model and everything, right? It'd be nice if there was some way to get insight into the nature of charge, though. And I was hoping that maybe this concept would help us approach that in a new way. Because, you know, if you can shed new light on the nature of space-time and gravity altogether with this information theory, you know, physics, it'd be neat if you could do something similar with charge.
Well, I mean, that does seem to be a little more fundamental, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have what gravity does. It has this strange connection to the inertia that we also don't understand. So this at least gives us a reason to think that maybe there's a connection. Verlinde's paper does seem to give a connection between inertia and gravity, which is very nice. You have some reason to think, well, why are these two things similar? Well, it's because they're both dealing with the entropy at some level. Huh. I'm not sure if that's true, though. Well, that's what his argument is.
Yeah, he seemed to derive an equation for inertia right there. Yeah, I'm using the change in entropy associated with the information on the boundaries.
Yeah, but I mean, at some point you have to wonder, what was all the physics that went into all this other stuff? You know, you have the Unruh acceleration, right? So what was all the physics that went into that? Do you know that?
He only very briefly touches on this in this paper, but as I understand it, the Unruh radiation is like when you accelerate against virtual particles in the vacuum and then they become real particles, right? So that you get this background temperature that you're going up against as you accelerate, but you'd have to go to some ridiculously high velocity to even begin detecting that radiation bath as real particles.
Yeah, so you're looking at that and you're saying something about Newton's second law or something similar to it probably ended up in that derivation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's just thinking about it. I might be wrong, right? Because, you know, the Unruh effect is something that we've talked about maybe doing a podcast on because, you know, we don't understand it. You know, you'd think that maybe in some of these cases, what you're doing is you're getting this acceleration out, but that acceleration somewhere in a derivation is in some way similar to Newton's second law already. Of course, again, I don't know, and I thought it was a pretty neat trick. Whether or not it's valid, I think it seems like an interesting theory for why there's acceleration since we don't have a good one anyway, or why there's inertia. So, I mean, I like it very much, but, I mean, unless you understand all the details, it's hard to be completely sure that this is really giving me what I think it's giving me.
Yeah, I remember reading some work by Hal Puthoff and Bernard Haich years ago. They were citing the Unruh effect, Unruh radiation as the source, as the origin of inertia. It seems like it comes into it in this paper, but he doesn't really delve into it. And it seems like it's more fundamental in this paper through these entropic arguments. I'm not sure if he even needs the Unruh effect to model this theory, right?
He doesn't need it for most of the rest of it. He only uses it for getting Newton's second law. And then he says, let's ignore that for the rest of the paper.
Yeah.
I only use this for this particular part to show that I could get the acceleration.
I think I might have been wrong. Is the Unruh effect only in a second time derivative effect? Or it would have to be, right? Otherwise, it would violate relativity.
Probably, but I don't really know. I mean, again, I did try to look it up real quick. I probably should have looked through some more of my books, but I didn't really see it. So I didn't really see a good explanation of it in the things that I have available to me.
That'll be a good topic. We'll look at it sometime.
Okay, let's look at it sometime. Let's do breaking news from 1973.
Well, you know, sometimes these things, you know, come up so rarely that, you know, it's easy to skip past them.
I don't have any problems with talking about things from 1973, especially something that I really don't understand and seems to be fundamental.
And it's still coming up in contemporary work that seems important. So why not?
Yeah, why not? Let's do it.
All right. Were there any other thoughts on this that you wanted to get into?
I didn't have anything else. I think I hit everything in my notes, which were not really great this time, but I think I hit everything in my notes. How about you? Anything else you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I'm just going to have to maybe read his next paper, too, because there's some outstanding questions that I have. Like, we were talking about the degrees of freedom. Does he even number how many degrees of freedom there are in a given spatial volume? I'm not really sure what he's talking about there.
No, he didn't. But like I said, it's probably based on the number of particles.
Okay.
So, and it sounds like it would be different depending on the density of different things. So it might be a random-y sort of number. But probably not. I mean, there's got to be something sort of on average about it. Exactly what that is, I don't know.
All right. So I think we're good. Let's get back to this sometime and do some follow-up on the development of this work.
Well, sounds good to me. Well, thank you very much for talking, Randy.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your time.
All right. Bye now.
Good night, everyone.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 42, Entropic Gravity. Show notes for this episode can be found at www.physicsfm.com/42. This includes links to the papers we were discussing, as well as related episodes and any other thing that I think would be interesting to you. We'd like to take this time to thank you for listening to our program. If you're still listening, we assume you like it, and that brings joy to our hearts. Thanks and good night.